eyes. Through the window, Evan saw a beam of light appear, a golden shaft piercing the gloom of the ground floor apartment, the upstairs mattress pulled back. He looked helplessly across the street at his rental car, 30 yards of high visibility through traffic. He'd never make it. The artist rose from the sidewalk, his flat cap askew. What kind of damn fool nonsense is this? The girl thrashed free of Evan, landing on all fours. She scampered across the blanket to get away, but it bunched beneath her knees, impeding her progress. Evan grabbed her arm, spun her up and around, and dumped her into the Cadillac's open trunk, shattering her straight through a painting of a dissected bassoon. He slammed the trunk an instant before she started battering at it. He snatched up the rucksack, slung it through the open rear window. If they hear you, they'll kill you. Her muffled shout came through the trunk. How do I know you're not going to kill me? Because I would have done it already. He hopped into the car. The keys waited in the ignition, enabling the radio and a pleasing whiff of air conditioning. As the concerto tinkled to a close, Evan looked out the open passenger window at the old artist. Through the window over the man's shoulder, he saw the first shadow tumble from the ceiling. Sorry about your art, Evan said, and peeled out. He wheeled around the edge of the complex, blending into traffic, coasting past the open mouth of the horseshoe. He looked back at the building. In the center of the parking lot, a man stood facing away, his head tilted up to take in the second floor, waiting. He would have looked like an ordinary guy, were it not for his posture. He stood with the perfect stillness of the perfectly trained. Orphan. One of the operators stepped out through the splintered door of 202 and gestured to the man with two fingers. He's on the run. Went down and out. The traffic light turned red and Evan hit the brakes, peering back transfixed as the man in the parking lot sprang into motion. He hit the front gate with his foot, vaulted up, ran 4 pounding steps along the high fence top, then leapt onto the outside of the stairwell cage. With a series of massive lunging leaps, he scaled the cage and then swung around onto the third floor corridor. He jumped up, grabbed the hanging roof ledge, and spun himself onto the roof, where he stood with the command of a mountaineer claiming an apex. He'd parkoured his way up the entire route in under 6 seconds. Evan allowed himself to be impressed. The man peered down, evidently picking up the commotion on the sidewalk outside apartment number 102. He began a slow rotation, pivoting like a weather vane, his eyes scanning the streets below. Evan turned back around in the driver's seat, cranked the side-view mirror to a severe tilt, and watched the man's reflection. The man finished his rotation, staring down at the mass of cars at the traffic light. It seemed like he was looking directly at Evan in the Cadillac, but of course there was no way it was possible from that distance. The light turned green, and Evan drove off. 12. Increasingly rural tangle. Keeping the needle pegged at the speed limit, Evan drove a circuitous route to the nearest freeway and ran past 4 exits before hopping off and shooting west through an increasingly rural tangle of desolate back roads. Gray clouds pervaded the sky, heavy with the promise of rain. Sure enough, a few drops tapped the roof, quickening to a rat-a-tat, ushering dusk into full night. Decreased visibility was good. It went both ways. Local law enforcement had undoubtedly already issued a be on the lookout for the Cadillac. He had to change vehicles. But first he needed to get a good distance between himself and the men who'd raided the apartment compound. Then he would regroup, determine what the package was, and deal with the problem in the trunk and the myriad questions that came with it. He closed his eyes, inhaled deeply, settled his shoulders. He blew out a breath, opened his eyes, and reset himself, assessing everything as if he were confronting it for the first time. Jack's dying message. A package. An address. A girl who was an orphan. Or at the very least, orphan-trained. Who was hostile. But not allied with the crew of men, led by another seeming orphan, who had raided the apartment complex in pursuit of her, the package, or Evan himself. A crew that had Van Sciver's fingerprints all over it, which left a whole lot of questions and very few answers. The rain thrummed and thrummed. The girl in the trunk banged a few times, shouted something unintelligible. The windshield wipers groaned and thumped. First order of business was to do a quick equipment appraisal. Evans scuffed knuckles. A fetching post-fight shade of eggplant ledged the steering wheel. His nose was freshly broken, leaking a trickle of crimson. Nothing bad. More a shifting along old fault lines. He inspected his nose in the rear view, then reached up and snapped it back into place. The Cadillac's alignment pulled to the right, threatening to dump him into the rain-filled roadside ditch. The seat springs poked into the backs of his thighs, and the fabric, dotted with cigarette scorch marks, reeked of menthol. The dome light housed a bare, burned-out bulb. The brake discs made a noise like an asphyxiating chicken, and the left rear brake light was out. He should have stolen a better car. Rain dumped down. That was Portland for you. Or if he was being precise, a country road outside Hillsboro. Big drops turned the roof into a tin drum. Water sluiced across the windshield, rooster-tailed from the tires. He slid it around a bend, passing a billboard. A moment later, smeared red and blue lights illuminated the caddy's rear window. A cop. The broken brake light. That was inconvenient. Especially on this car, since a bolo had likely been issued. The cop would be running the plate number now if he hadn't already. Evan blew out a breath, leaned harder into the gas pedal. Here came the sirens. The headlights grew larger. Evan could see the silhouette of the officer behind the wheel. So much like a shooting target, head and chest, all critical mass. Hillsboro prided itself on being one of the safest cities in the Pacific Northwest. Evan hoped to keep it that way. As he popped the brakes and jerked the wheel, the heap of a car rocked on its shocks, fanning onto an intersecting road. Two more cop cars swept in behind him from the opposite direction. Evan sighed. Three patrol cars lit up like Christmas, sirens screaming, spreading out across both lanes and closing in. That was when the thumping from the trunk grew more pronounced. He checked the wheel, loose enough to jog 2 inches in either direction with no effect on the steering. He was going to have to attempt tactical driving maneuvers in a car that should not be highway approved. Evan had spent a portion of the summer of his 15th year on a specialized course in the sticks of Virginia, with Jack in the passenger seat keeping one hand on the wheel, steering him through everything from evasive driving to acceleration techniques in challenging traction environments. Just another kid out with his old man, learning to drive. In their final conversation, he'd told Jack, "I wouldn't trade knowing you for anything." He felt it now not as a sentiment, but as a warmth in his chest. He was glad he'd gotten the words out. The Cadillac backfired. The motor sounded like it had a marble loose in it. Evan grimaced. "All right, Jack. Let's do this together." He started to alternate brake and gas, playing with the pursuing cruisers, forcing them to alter their lineup. At last, one separated from the pack, moving bullishly to the fore. Evan held the wheel steady, luring the lead car closer. A crackly loudspeaker pierced the rain. "Pull over immediately! Repeat! Pull to the side of the road!" Evan called back to the girl in the trunk. "You might want to brace yourself." The girl shouted, "Great!" He unholstered his Aries. 17 bullets. The lead car crept up alongside him, nosing parallel to the caddy's rear tires. The pit maneuver, or precision immobilization technique, was adapted from an illegal bump-and-run strategy used in stock car racing. The pursuing car taps the target vehicle just behind the back wheel, then veers hard into the car and accelerates. The target vehicle loses traction and spins out. The lead cop car was preparing for it now. Unfortunately for him, so was Evan. He waited, letting the cruiser ease a few more inches into position at the rear of the caddy. Then, he hit the brakes. He flew backward, catching a streak of the driver's oh-shit face as he rocketed by. The cars had perfectly reversed positions, the do-si-do taking all of half a second. Evan crumpled the sturdy prow of the caddy into the rear of the cruiser, steered into the crash, and stumped on the gas pedal. The cruiser acquiesced to the laws of physics, shearing sideways. It wrapped around the grill of the Cadillac in a series of elegant mini-collisions before fishtailing off. As Evan motored ahead onto open road, he watched in the rear view as the cruiser wiped out one of its Confederates, wadding them both into the roadside ditch, where they steamed in a tangle of bent chassis and collapsed tires. One set of headlights held steady, navigating through, sticking to the caddy's rear. A quarter mile flew by, then another, as Evan and the last cop standing gauged each other. The cop finally fainted forward, trying to steer into position, but Evan held him off by veering squarely in front of him. They kept on that way, swerving unevenly across the sodden road, the cruiser coming on, Evan answering with avoidance maneuvers. The caddy was growing weary, the reaction time a little worse by the second. Evan was pushing it to the limit, but it was a low limit. He eyed the mirror. The cruiser gathered itself on its haunches, readying to dart forward again to deal a decisive blow. All right, Jack. What next? First of all, get off your heels, son. The ninth commandment. Always play offense. Right, Evan said to the empty passenger seat. He raised his 1911, turned away, and shot out the windshield. It spiderwebbed, but the laminate held it in place. With the heel of his hand, Evan knocked out the ruined glass and rain crashed in over him, a wave of spiky cold. Evan stomped the brake hard and whipped the wheel around. The boat tilted severely as the back swung forward, slewing through mud. For a moment, Evan thought it might flip. But it righted itself into a sloppy 180, Evan jerking the transmission into reverse and letting the wheel spool back through his loose fists. Gears screamed. So did the girl in the trunk. Already he'd seated the gas pedal against the floor, capturing what forward momentum he'd had, except now he was driving in reverse, nose to nose with the cruiser, their bumpers nearly kissing. The young cop at the wheel blinked at him. They hurtled along the road, two kids in a standoff on a seesaw. Except the seesaw was traveling 50 miles per hour. Wind howled around the maw of the windshield. Driving backward protected Evan from the rain. He had a clear view over the top of his pistol, and no bullet-deflecting glass between him and the target. Before the cop could react, Evan jogged the wheel slightly, offsetting the vehicles, opening up an angle to the side of the cruiser. He shot out the front tire. 15 rounds left. As the cruiser wobbled and lost acceleration, Evan braked in time with it, holding it in his pistol sights the entire way. Both cars slowed, slowed, gently nodding to their respective halts. They faced each other, about 10 yards apart. Pistol locked on the cop, Evan got out of the caddy. His boots shoved mounds in the soggy ground. The rain had stopped, but the air still felt pregnant, raising beads of condensation on his skin. His shirt felt like a wet rag. The cop was still buckled in, fingers locked on the steering wheel, collecting himself. Out, Evan said. Hands. The cop unbuckled and climbed out. Sweat trickled down his face, clung to the strands of his starter mustache. He stood in the V of his open door. Evan indicated for him to step clear of the car, which he did. He looked earnest and stalwart standing there before the block lettering of his cruiser. Hillsborough PD. A holstered Glock rode his right hip. His hands were shaking, but only slightly. He wore a wedding ring. A muffled voice yelled from the caddy's trunk. "Don't do it! Don't you hurt him!" The cop stiffened, licked his lips. "Who's that?" Evan said, "I'm not sure yet." The cop inched his hands down a bit. "You have a family," Evan told him. The cop said, "And you've got a girl in the trunk of your stolen vehicle." "I'll admit there are rare occasions on which there's a reasonable explanation for that," Evan said. "This is one of them." The cop did not look impressed with that. "I'm not going to hurt her," Evan said. "Forgive me for not taking you at your word." The breeze swept a bitter fresh scent of churned soil and roadside weeds. The cop's right hand twitched ever so slightly, raised there over the holster. He was the kind of guy who worked hard, helped his neighbors, stayed up late watching westerns on TV. "Kids?" Evan asked. The cop nodded. "Daughter." "She's 5. His Adam's apple lurched with a strained swallow. "I have to look her in the eye every morning and every night and know I did the right thing." "Think this through," Evan said. "Do I seem like a guy who doesn't know what he's doing?" The cop's hand dove for his pistol. It got only halfway there before Evan fired. 13. Dying only meant one thing. Evan's shot clipped the rear sights of the cop's holstered Glock. The force of the round flipped the entire holster back off the cop's waistband. It made a single lazy rotation and landed in a drainage ditch with a plop, vanishing into the murky brown water. Evan hadn't wanted to waste another bullet, but there it was, down to 14. When the cop blew out his next breath, he made a noise like a moan. He leaned over, hands on his knees. "Couple deep breaths," Evan said. "Okay. You're gonna radio in that you got me, and you're taking me in."
"Okay."
"Right now." The cops Evan had left in the wreckage several miles behind them on the road would have called in a rough location for backup already, which meant that Van Sciver would hear, because Van Sciver heard everything. As the cop leaned in for his radio, Evan stayed tight on him in case he went for the mounted shotgun. But the cop's nerve had deserted him. "Unit 17 to dispatch. I have apprehended the suspect and am heading home to HQ. Over."
"Copy that, 17. We will call off the cavalry."
Evan reached around the cop, yanked the transmission into neutral, and snatched the keys from the ignition. Both men jerked clear as the cruiser forged through the mud, bounced across the ditch, and plowed off the road. Bushes rustled around it, and then it was gone. Evan said, "March." At the point of Evan's Ares, the cop walked off the road, through a stand of ash trees, and onto the marshy land beyond. "Kneel," Evan said. The cop stopped on a patch of bluegrass. His knees made a sucking sound in the wet earth. Evan stood behind him. "Close your eyes."
"Wait."
The word cracked, came out in 2 syllables.
"My daughter, the 5-year-old. Her name is Ashley. She wakes up. Watches from my headlights every night. Plays with her American Girl doll in the bay window by the kitchen. Won't go to sleep until I'm there."
He choked in a few gulps of air.
"I promised her I'd always come home. Don't make a liar out of me. Please. Don't make a liar out of me."
Silence.
"Do you have kids? A wife? Parents, then? Think about them. How they'd feel if you... or if something happened to them. Think about how you'd feel if it was something someone did. Something that wasn't even necessary. If they were taken from you."
He fell downward onto his hands. His eyes were still closed, but he felt his fingers push into the yielding earth. He thought about his body landing here, taken in by the spongy ground. He waited for the bullet.
Any second now. Any second.
Would he feel it? A pinpoint pressure at the base of his skull before the lights went out? He thought about the chewed corner of his daughter's blankie, the smell of her head, how when she was newborn, her feet used to curl when she cried. He thought about his wife's face beneath her white veil, how he couldn't quite see her, just a sliver of cheek, of eye, until the minister had said the magic 5 words and he'd lifted the soft tulle fabric and uncovered her beaming back at him. He thought about how dying only meant one thing, and that was not seeing them again. How lucky he was to have been given that purpose, and how wretched it must be for all the lost souls out there who floated through their years, adrift and alone. 20 minutes passed, maybe more, before it dawned on him that he wasn't dead. He opened his eyes, peered down at his hands, lost to the bluegrass. He pulled back onto his haunches, moving as slowly as he'd ever moved, and turned around. There was nothing there but wind shivering the leaves of the trees. 14. A pang of something unfamiliar. Evan stood at the trunk of the Cadillac. Golden light filtered through the high windows of the ancient barn, lending a fairy tale tint to the hay-streaked ground and empty stables. He braced himself and opened the trunk. The girl erupted from inside. This time Evan was ready. He ducked, and the tire iron strobed by, fractions from his skull. She landed, spun, and came at him again, but it was half-hearted. She knew she'd lost her one good shot. He stripped the tire iron from her hands and deflected her onto the ground. She lay there panting, a strand of glossy brown-black hair caught in the corner of her mouth. "Well," she said, and spit out the strand. "Can't blame me for trying." "No," Evan said. She sat, laced her hands across her knees, rolled back slightly onto her behind, and looked up at him. Broad cheekbones, long lashes, vibrant emerald eyes. The pose was youthful, disarming. She might have been watching a movie at a slumber party. But there was something haunted beneath her strong features, as if in her brief life she'd seen more than she'd wanted to.
"You killed him, didn't you?" she said.
"The cop?"
"No," she said. "Not the cop."
"Who?"
"I only had him for a few months," she said. "I finally had someone who..."
Then she went blank, a screen powering down. "Who?" he said. Silence. He tried a different tack. "What's your name?"
"Joey."
Same empty expression. "What's it short for?" Her eyes whirred back to life, clicked over to him.
"None of your business."
She looked up at the high rafters.
"Where the hell are we?"
"Off the beaten path."
"What's the plan?"
"Leave the caddy here. There's a working truck outside a storage shed a click and a half north. I take that and leave you here. After."
"After what?"
"You give me the package. We can go through your things piece by piece, or you can tell me. But there's no way this isn't happening." She just stared at him. "Look, Joey, you know how this works. You were a classified government weapon."
"No. Let's be clear."
She stood up, half-crossed her arms, one hand gripping the opposite elbow. Her shoulders tensed, rolled forward, defensive. "I'm a defective model of a classified government weapon. I got pulled off the assembly line."
"Meaning?"
"I washed out, okay? I didn't make it."
"Who was your handler?"
"Orphan Y," she said. "Charles Van Sciver."
Hearing the full name spoken aloud in the muffled damp of the barn, it was a profanity. For a moment, Evan was unsure if she'd actually said it or if he'd conjured it, spun it into life from the primordial soup of his own obsession. He breathed the sweet rot of old wood. His throat felt dry.
"He trained you?" "Yeah,"
she said.
"Until he didn't."
He fought to grasp the contours of this. Van Sciver was neutralizing the remaining orphans, everyone that wasn't his inner cadre. Yeah, well, he decided to rev up recruitment again. More assets, more power. A stab of eagerness punctuated Evan's confusion. "So that's the package. Information on Van Sciver." "No," she said. "I don't have any of that." "Then what were you doing in that apartment?"
"I lived there," she said.
"What were you doing in that apartment?"
"Jack Johns sent me."
Her stance shifted at once, forward ready.
"Who the hell are you?
How do you know Jack Johns?"
"He was my handler."
"Bullshit," she said. "Bullshit! Where is he?"
"He's dead."
Her eyes welled with an abruptness that caught him off guard, emotion rushing to the surface.
"I knew it. You killed him."
"Jack was a father to me."
"No."
"No." Her hands were balled up tightly.
if that was true. If he was your handler, you wouldn't have killed those cops.
I didn't.
Never let an innocent die.
The cops are all... He cut off in mid-sentence. What did you just say? It seemed all the oxygen had gone out of the barn.
Nothing.
The 10th commandment, Evan said. She glowered at him, and then her face shifted just slightly. No one would have gotten the commandments out of Jack. Evan knew that, which meant she knew it too. The first, she said. What's the first commandment?
Assume nothing. He drew in a breath. The 8th?
Never kill a kid. She brushed her hair out of her face, her lips slightly parted, her expression heavy with something like awe. When she spoke again, it was a whisper.
Your orphan eggs.
The wood creaked around them. Dust motes swirled, fuzzing the air. Evan gave the faintest nod.
Evan, she said.
There was something intimate in her saying his first name.
He told me about you.
He didn't tell me about you.
Jack saved me when I broke with the program.
Saved you?
You know how it is with Van Sciver. Either you're with him, or...
She didn't have to complete the thought.
Look, I told you. I'm not a government weapon. I'm not an orphan. I'm just a girl. It dawned on him. A full body shiver like a wash of cold water. He sat down against the caddy's bumper, tilted his forehead into the tent of his fingers.
What?
She said.
Jack wants me to look after you.
Look after me?
Evan gazed up at her, felt the blood drain from his face.
You're the package.
They moved beneath the bright moon, high-stepping through a field of summer squash, vectoring for the truck Evan had scouted earlier. Joey's bulging rucksack bounced on her shoulders, made her lean frame look schoolgirl small.
What the hell had Jack been thinking?
Evan felt a pang of something unfamiliar.
Guilt?
He pictured Jack free-falling through the Alabama night and let in some rage to wash the guilt away.
Let's be clear, Evan said. I'm not Jack. It's not what I do. I'll get you to safety, square you away, and that'll be that.
Her face had closed off again, unreadable. Their boots squelched. An owl was at it in one of the dark trees, asking the age-old question, who, who?
How'd Van Sciver's men find my apartment? She asked.
They were closing in on Jack. They must have gotten the address somewhere, staked it out.
You sure you weren't followed?
Yes.
If they knew I was there, why wouldn't they just have killed me?
Because I'm more valuable to them.
Oh. So they only let me live to lure you in?
Yes. A burning in his cheek announced itself. He raised his fingertips, felt the distinct edge. He picked out the safety glass pebble and flicked it to the ground. The girl was talking again.
Van Sciver had Jack killed.
He kept on, letting her process it. It was a lot to process. She dimpled her lower lip between her teeth.
I can help you go after Van Sciver.
Evan halted, faced her in the moonlight.
How old are you? 20?
No.
18?
No. She squirmed a bit more.
16.
He started up again, and she hurried to stay at his side. The only colors were shades of gray and sepia. The moonlight ripened the green squash to a pale yellow.
How did you know?
She asked. When you lie, your blink rate picks up. You've also got a one-shouldered shrug that's a tell. And your hands. Just keep your hands at your sides. Your body language talks more than you do, and that's saying something.
God, she said, you sound just like Jack. He took a moment with that one.
They cleared the squash and came onto a stretch where something, pumpkins, had been recently harvested. Hacked vines populated the barren patch, pushing up from the earth like gnarled limbs. An aftermath scent lingered, fecund and autumnal, the smell of life and death. It doesn't matter how old I am, she said. I can help.
How? Do you have locations? Addresses for Van Sciver?
Of course not. You know how he is. Everything's end-stopped 6 different ways. I didn't even know where I was most of the time.
Do you have any actionable intel on him?
Not really.
Do you know why Jack was in Alabama?
She colored slightly. Is that where he died?
Joey, listen. You're raw, totally unbroken. I'm not a horse, no. You're a Mustang. You fight well. You have extraordinary coordination. But you're not finished, let alone operational.
Jack sent you to me.
To protect you, not get you killed.
I have training.
She was angry now, punching every word. I knocked you on your ass, didn't I? You can't imagine the kind of violence that's coming. Did Jack advise you to just ship me off somewhere to hide for the rest of my life?
The shed loomed ahead, a dark mass rising from the earth, the outline of the beater truck beside it.
Evan quickened his pace. Jack died before he knew how this would all unfold. I have only one concern now, and that is finding Van Sciver and every person who had a hand in Jack's death, and killing them.
Evan pulled open the creaky truck door and flipped down the visor. The keys landed in his palm. He looked back at Joey.
What am I supposed to do with you?
I'm not useless. I never said that.
She came around the passenger side, got in, slammed the door.
Yeah, she said. You did.
15. Just geometry. The neon sign announcing the motel in Cornelius had lost its M and L, blaring a woeful orange otet into the night. The place was rickety, despite being single-story. Tucked beneath the freeway ramp, the pitted check-in desk manned by a woman who smacked watermelon gum vigorously to cover the scent of schnapps. It was perfect. Evan checked in solo, prepaid in cash, and didn't have to produce any details of the alias he had at the ready. Not the kind of establishment that made inquiries of its patrons. The woman never looked him in the face, her attention captured by a hangnail she was working to limited success with her front teeth. The security camera was a fake, a dusty plastic decoy drilled into the wall for show. He signed the book Pierre Picot, took the key that was inexplicably attached to a duct-taped water bottle, and trudged like a road-weary salesman to room 6. As he opened the door, Joey materialized from the shadows and slipped inside with him. She dumped her rucksack on the ratty carpet, regarded a crooked watercolor of hummingbirds at play.
Look, she said, art.
Really spruces up the place. She gestured to a corner.
I can sleep there.
I'll take the floor.
I'm younger.
The bed looks shitty anyways. I want to be right by the door, Evan said.
She shrugged.
Fine. She fell back stiffly onto the mattress, a trust fall with no one there to catch her. There was a great creaking of coils.
I think you got the better deal.
That bad?
It feels like lying on a bag of wrenches.
No, not quite that bad.
Maybe like rubber-handled wrenches?
Well then.
And I'm used to some shitty places, she said.
That's the biggest thing the program has on foster home kids, he said. We think wherever we're going isn't as bad as where we've been.
She lifted her head, putting chin to chest, the diffuse neon glow of the sign turning her eyes feral.
Yeah, well, foster homes are different for girls.
Like how?
Like none of your fucking business.
Okay.
I never talk about it.
Never.
Okay.
She let her head fall back again.
Evan followed her gaze. The water-stained ceiling looked like a topographical map. He wondered if anyone ever knew what went on inside the mind of a teenage girl.
Do you have a legend? Evan asked her.
Jack was getting me a passport, driver's license. It was still in process when...
Airport's out in that case.
That's okay. They're expecting it anyway.
What's the plan, then?
First train departs Portland at 8 a.m.
Okay.
So, a train.
To where?
She waved a hand dismissively.
Doesn't matter.
We'll make arrangements. Make sure you're taken care of.
Yeah.
Anything I need to know about Van Sciver?
Now's the time to tell me. She sat up, crossed her legs. I didn't interact with him privately much, if that's what you mean.
Anything.
He took me when I was 14.
He's the one who found you?
No, it was a guy. Old as death. Gold watch, always smoking. Wears Ray-Bans all the time, even at night.
Something crept back to life inside Evan's chest. Something he'd thought long dead. Boy's mass in a bedroom doorway at Pride House Group Home. Evan at the bottom, always the smallest. They peer down the hall at a man, but can see only a partial profile. He is extending a solid black business card to Papa Z between two slender fingers. A gold wristwatch glints, dangling from a thin wrist.
Mystery man, Evan said. She cocked her head. Most of all, he remembered the helplessness. 12 years old, his fate in the control of forces so large and unseen, they might as well have been ancient gods. Being asked to jump and jump again, never knowing if there'd be earth underfoot, if he'd ever land. Until there was Jack, the bedrock to his life. When Joey had landed, it was with Van Sciver. Her upturned face waited for him to say something. He wondered how she had scraped her way through her 16 years. That pang knifed through him again, but he ignored it, turned his thoughts to business.
How did he choose you? Evan asked, the mystery man.
He watched us all at first, playing in the yard, just observing. For some reason, he picked me out one day, drove me a good ways to a marine base. I don't remember which one, but I was in Phoenix, so I'd guess now it was Yuma. He walked me into a giant training facility. The whole inside of the building had been converted to an indoor obstacle course. It had everything. Barbed wire crawl, mud pits, rope climbs, tire pulls, traverse walls. The most stuff I'd ever seen. The place just crammed with it. At the end of the course, there was a bell. And when you finish, you know, you ring it. The old guy had a stopwatch. He said, the sole aim is to get from point A to point B in the fastest time possible. I was wearing a dress and sandals. I said, the sole aim? And he said, that's right. She paused and again bit her plush lower lip. Her front teeth were slightly too big, spaced with a hair-thin gap. The imperfection was endearing. Without it, her features would have been too smooth, too perfect.
What did you do? Evan asked.
I turned around and walked out, she said. Then I circled the building from the outside, went through a service door by the end of the course, and rang the bell. I looked across at him. And he was still standing there. Hadn't even started the stopwatch yet.
Smart.
She shrugged. It's just geometry.
And then?
2 seconds later, the old guy's cell phone rings. There must have been cameras there. By the time I'd walked back around, he had a syringe in his hand. I don't remember him sticking me, or anything else.
She paused.
I never saw anyone again.
Where'd you wake up?
Maryland. But I didn't find that out until 11 months later when I escaped.
Van Sciver kept you in a house for an entire year?
A house? She coughed out a laugh. I lived on an abandoned Air Force installation. My bed was a mattress in a hangar. I ate, slept, trained. That's it. Usually with other instructors. Van Sciver only dropped by now and then to gauge my progress.
Was he pleased with it?
Yeah.
Until,
she pulled in a deep breath. One night I woke up, heard noises, a man crying. I don't know why it's worse than when a woman does, but it was. I crept over to the raised office area, you know, up a short set of stairs. It had the only window. I looked out and saw Van Sciver stuffing an unconscious guy into a duffel bag. Then they carried the duffel toward the hangar. I ran back. Pretended to be asleep. Van Sciver came in, woke me. He handed me a Glock 21. In him, the Gen 4.
Evan was suddenly aware of how cool the room was. She said,
I asked what we were doing, and he said,
it is what it is, and that's all that it is, Evan said.
She stared at him.
Cognitive closure, Evans said. Van Sciver's mode of thinking. A strong preference for order, which, okay, a lot of us have. But it's paired with a distaste for ambiguity. That's why Jack cultivated it in us. Ambiguity. That's the part that keeps you human. Question orders, she said, her voice a hoarse whisper. The sixth commandment. He nodded. She swallowed, was silent a moment, then continued. So I took the gun. I didn't feel like I had a choice. Van Sciver walked me over to the duffel, told me to shoot it. I asked why. He said it was an order, and orders don't come with whys. I could see the guy's outline there inside the duffel. In the neon glow, Evan caught a sheen on her forehead. Sweat. She shook her head, breaking off the story. We've all done shit we regret. I regret every day of my life what I did. Sliding off the bed, she dug in her rucksack. She pulled out a few toiletries, which she shelved to her chest with an arm, and disappeared into the bathroom. A moment later, the shower turned on. Evan looked at the open mouth of her rucksack. A piece of paper had fallen out. He picked it up to put it away for her, when he saw that it was a birthday card. Tattered envelope. No address. The front of the card featured a colorful, "You're 16," though much of the glitter had been worn off from handling. A well-loved card. Evan opened it. A pressed iris had been preserved inside, already brittle. Know that I am proud of you, sweet girl, that I see the beautiful woman you have grown into. XOXO, M. Evan stared at the scrawled feminine hand for a time, felt a stirring inside him. Was M the mom who had lost Joey into the foster system? It certainly wasn't Orphan M. Evan had left his pieces scattered on a roadway in Zagreb. But how would M have been in touch with Joey? Joey would have been taken off the grid when she was tapped for the orphan program. Jack must have arranged some way to re-establish contact between daughter and mother, mailbox forwarding or a dead drop. It would have been a lot of trouble to get done correctly, and Jack only did things correctly, which meant that whoever M was, she meant a lot to Joey. Evan put the card away, careful not to fragment the dried flower further, and found a plug to charge his rum zone. Crouched over the faint green glow, he pondered what he would do if a nowhere man call rang through right now. The missions formed an endless chain, each client passing on his untraceable number to the next. That was the only fee he charged for his services. He'd found that this simple act was also part of the healing process for clients, a first step on the road to putting their lives back together. What was more empowering than helping to rescue another person? For the first time since he'd become the Nowhere Man, he felt unready to answer if the black phone rang. Holed up in a motel in Cornelius, Jack's death still unavenged, stuck with a 16-year-old who was at her best difficult to manage. He was in no state to handle a mission. He reminded himself that 6 hours from now, things would get drastically simpler. He just had to hold out until that first train pulled into Union Station. He'd have Joey off his plate. Then he'd run Van Sciver to ground and put a bullet through his skull. The shower turned off, and a few minutes later Joey emerged, towel wrapped around her. She gestured at the rucksack. Do you mind if I, You change out here. I'll clean up. They passed awkwardly, giving each other a wide berth. In the bathroom, he leaned close to the mirror and studied his face, nicked in several places from the shattered windshield. The sterile light caught a dab of dried blood at the corner of his mouth. Only then did he become aware of a throbbing above his right incisor. He lifted his upper lip, saw that the tooth was outlined in crimson. Above it, a dot of safety glass speckled in his gum line. He worked it free with his fingers, dropped it in the trash. Then he rinsed out his mouth and nose, brushed his teeth using Joey's toothpaste and his finger, and went back into the room. She was in bed, facing away, her breathing already slow and steady. She'd left a pillow on the floor for him.
He lay down on the carpet near the door and closed his eyes. He awoke to movement in the room, stayed perfectly still, kept his eyes veiled, mostly closed. Joey continued to ease out of bed, moving so slowly she didn't even creak the hair trigger coils. 2 silent steps, and then she hunched over her rucksack, reaching for something. She rose, turned. He watched her approach. Her hand passed through a fall of light from the window. She was holding her fixed-blade combat knife. She moved well, floating on bare feet. He read her posture. Her shoulders were hunched, her head lowered on her neck. Nothing in it registered aggression. Just fear. She leaned over him. He made the call to let her. He felt the carbon steel blade press against his throat. He opened his eyes all the way. Her own eyes were so large, the light coming through them from the side turning the irises transparent. The vivid green of them jumped out of the dark, the eyes of a great cat that no longer knew itself to be great. "Don't hurt me ever," she said. "Please." "Okay." He felt the word grind against the knife edge. She nodded, and then nodded again, as if to herself. The pressure eased. She withdrew as silently as she'd approached. He laid there and stared at the water-stained map of the ceiling. The whole world laid out in its darkness and complexity. 16. The Turn to Freedom. A 4-sided Romanesque revival clock tower adorned with lit signage staked Portland Union Station to the west shore of the Willamette River. Evan hustled Joey beneath the go-by train flashing sign and into the glossy Italian marble waiting room, where he bought her a ticket under an alias on a train heading for Ashland, Kentucky, because the choice struck him as sufficiently random. The route ran through Sacramento and Chicago. Between travel time and layovers, that would keep her on the move for nearly 3 days. He steered her out onto the chill of the platform, handed her the Amtrak tickets and a wad of cash. "My email address is the.nowhere.man@gmail.com, he told her. "Say it back to me." She did, her first words in nearly 20 minutes. He took her gently by the arm, hustled her down to the far end of the platform. "When you get to Ashland, log into my account." He told her the password. "Type a message to me in the drafts folder. Do not send it. I will log in, leave you instructions in the same unsent email. If it doesn't ever travel over the internet, I know the protocols," she said. She turned and waited for the train. A limp wind fluttered her hair, and she hooked it behind an ear, exposing a swath of the shaved area. Frustratingly, his feet kept him rooted there. "Watch your back better," he said. "Use windows as mirrors, like there or there. The reflections off passing trains. Watch your visibility, too. You should be noting where surveillance cameras are, minding their sight lines, head down." Her lower jaw moved forward, and he heard a clicking of teeth. "I know the protocols." "Then move 4 inches back behind this post," he said. She stepped beneath the metal overhang and shot him a glare. He said, "If you don't know what you don't know..." "How can I know what to learn?" she said. "Jack told me that one, too, like I said. The protocols? I know them." "Okay," he said. "Okay," she said. He left her on the platform. Staying alert, he carved his way back through the waiting room, scanning the crowd. His nose looked okay, but the break had left thumbprint bruises beneath his eyes, so he preferred to avoid looking anyone directly in the face. With each step, he sensed the distance widening between him and Joey, between him and Jack's final, ill-considered wish. His boots tapped the cold, shiny marble. It felt like walking through a tomb. He came out the front, hustled across the hourly pay parking lot to a Subaru with a "My Child is Student of the Month" bumper sticker. He'd swapped out vehicles early that morning in an office garage, taking advantage of a parking attendant's bathroom break to snatch a set of keys from a valet podium. assuming the proud parent worked a full day. That gave Evan until 5 o'clock before the car would be reported missing. He'd backed into the parking spot, giving him privacy by the rear bumper. He knelt down now and removed the license plate, switching it out for that of the Kia in the neighboring slot. One more layer of protection before he hit the road, free and clear to resume his pursuit of Van Sciver. He got into the car and pulled out of the parking lot, eyeing the freeway signs. He was just about to make the turn to freedom when he checked the rear view and saw the Hillsboro Home Theater installation van turn into Union Station. 17. A single hungry lunge. A Hertz rental sedan moved in concert with the van. They parked side by side at the outer edge of the parking lot, reversing into the spots to allow for a quick getaway. Three husky men emerged from the van. They wore commuter clothes, dockers and button-ups. Muscle swelled the fabric. There was no way around that. Loose-fitting jackets to conceal their builds and their pistols. They entered the waiting room and spread out immediately, fighter jets peeling out of formation. The driver in the sedan stayed put, his head rotating as he scanned the parking lot and roads leading to the train station. The lookout. The men streaked through the waiting room, sidling between passengers and heavy oak benches. They stepped out of three different doors onto the platform and into the shade of the overhang. In the distance, a freight train approached, woo-wooing a warning, rumbling the ground. The whistle would provide good audio cover for a gunshot. The men looked through the clusters of waiting passengers on the side platform and the two island platforms beyond. One of the men spotted a rucksack tilting into view from behind a wooden post at the end, and part of a girl's leg. His head swiveled, and he caught the eye of the man in the middle, whose head swiveled in turn to pick up the last man. They shouldered their way along the platform, closing the space between one another. Woo-woo. The freight train wasn't slowing. It would blow right through the station, giving even more sound cover. The girl was isolated there at the end of the platform. That provided relative privacy to get the job done. Woo-woo. They converged on her, now shoulder to shoulder, linemen coming in for the sack. 15 yards away. Woo-woo. She saw them only now. Alarm flashed across her face, but even so she stepped back into a fighting posture, hands raised, jaw set. The man in the middle reached inside his loose-fitting jacket. They swept forward, 10 yards away. Behind them a form swung down from the metal overhang and crouched on the landing to break his fall, one hand pressed to the concrete, soundless. Evan couldn't fire his Ares, not with Joey in the background. But that was okay. He was eager to use his hands. Joey spotted him through the gap between the advancing men. They read her eyes, the change in her stance. They turned. Three men, one pistol drawn, two on the way. Evan moved on the gun first. A jiu-jitsu double-hand parry to a figure-four armbar, the pleasing snap-snap of wrist and elbow breaking, and Jack sways in the Black Hawk, hands cuffed behind him, wind blasting his hair when the pistol skittered free across the tracks, the guy on his knees, his arm turned to rubber. The second man gave up on the draw and came at Evan with a haymaker, but Evan threw a palm heel strike to the bottom of his chin, rocking his head back. He firmed his fingers, drove a hand spear into the exposed throat, crushing the windpipe. The man toppled, crashing through a trash can, and made a gargling sound. His access to oxygen closed now and forever, and Jack reeled back, a parachute ripcord handle clenched in his teeth, his eyes blazing with triumph when the third man's gun had cleared leather, so Evan grabbed his wrist, shoved the pistol back into the hip holster, hooked his thumb through the trigger guard, and fired straight down through the tip of the holster and the guy's foot. The man was still gaping at the bloody mess on the end of his ankle when Evan reversed the pistol out of the holster, spun it around the same thumb, and squeezed off a shot that took off half the guy's jaw. Evan blinked through the spatter, and the image of Jack's parting nod to the men pinballing around the lurching Black Hawk, a nod filled with peace, with resignation before he stepped out into the abyss. People were screaming now, stampeding off the platform, the express train bearing down, two corpses on the concrete, a glassy puddle of deep red spreading, smooth enough to reflect the clouds in the sky. The first man remained on his knees, straddling the yellow safety line on the platform, gripping his ruined arm as the hand flopped noodle-like on the broken stalk of the limb. Despite all reason, he was trying to firm it, to make his wrist work again, when Evan wound into a reverse sidekick, driving the bottom of his heel into the edge of the man's jaw and sending him flying over the tracks, just in time to catch the woo-woo freight train as it blasted through, fly-swatting him ahead and grinding him underneath in what seemed like a single hungry lunge. Joey stared at Evan across the expanding puddle and the sprawled legs of the third man. Furrows grooved the skin of her forehead. She had forgotten to breathe. The engagement had lasted 4 seconds, maybe 5. The other man had landed to the side, propped against the toppled trash can, one hand pawing the air above his collapsed windpipe. The motion grew slower and slower. Joey looked at him and then back at Evan, her eyes even wider. "He's dead," Evan said. "He just doesn't know it yet." She cleared her throat. "Thanks. Grab your rucksack. Let's go." She did. They barreled through the doors into the waiting room. Chaos reigned. People shoved and elbowed to the exit. A homeless man was bellowing to himself, stuffing his bedding into a shopping cart. Workers cowered behind counters. There were sirens outside already, flashing lights coloring the parking lot. Lead responders spilled through the front entrance, bucking the stream of humanity. "This way." Evan grabbed Joey's arm, ushered her up the corridor to the bathrooms. They were halfway there when a service door swung open, and two cops shouldered through. Their eyes lasered in on Evan and Joey, Glocks drawn, but aimed at the floor. Evan swung her around, reversing course. They didn't get 3 steps when, up ahead, responding cops filled the waiting room. They were trapped. 18. Short on time, and short on crowbars. Behind them, one of the cops shouted, "Wait! Stop right there!" Evan and Joey froze, still facing away. The corridor was empty, squeaky clean, save for a dropped newspaper and fresh plug of gum stuck to the wall.
"What now?"
Joey said to Evan out of the side of her mouth. "We don't kill cops." Ahead, PD started locking down the big hall. Behind them, the cops' boots squeaked on the marble as they approached cautiously.
"I know," Joey whispered. "So what do we do?"
"Get arrested. Face the consequences, whatever they are. We go down before we break a commandment." The cops were right behind them. "Turn around. Right now." Joey reached up and flipped her hair over, exposing the shaved side of her head in its entirety. She brushed against Evan as she pivoted around, and when he followed her lead, he saw that she had his room zone in hand. "This is totally not fair," she said. "Some big guy ran past us, all freaking out, and whammed into me. I dropped my phone, and it's like ruined." Her posture had transformed, shoulders slumped, twisty legs, head lolling lazily to one side, a finger twirling a tendril of hair. Even her face had gone slack with teenage apathy. And she was chewing gum, with teenage vigor. Evan shot a look at the spot on the wall where the fluorescent green plug had been a moment before. Joey yanked on Evan's arm.
"Dad, you are buying me a new phone. Like now! There's no way I'm going to school with the screen all cracked."
Evan cleared his throat. "I'm sorry, officers." The cops looked behind them.
"A big guy ran past you? This way?"
"Yeah. You, like, just missed him." The cops exchanged a look and bolted back down the corridor to the service door. Joey called after them,
"If you find him, tell him he's paying for my new phone!"
The door banged shut after them. Joey swept her hair back into place, blanketing the shaved side. Adapt what is useful, reject what is useless, and add what is specifically your own.
Odysseus?
She took the gum out of her mouth, stuck it back on the wall.
Bruce Lee.
He nodded,
Right. They moved swiftly out